Okay, call the meeting to order. And start with the minutes. Oh, we don't have a quorum yet, do we? Okay. I'll take a motion to move the minutes.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Deborah Histon, or Representative Histon. The minutes are moved. All in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The first bill today, Representative Hillstrom, moves H. House File 410, recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Members, House File 410 is a bill that relates to crime victims and the collection of restitution after the victim is deceased. Members, there is an amendment in your packet. This is actually a request by the Department of Public Safety just to amend to say that if someone else already has another right, that this new language doesn't affect anyone else's previous rights under statute. And I would ask that you move that amendment to put the bill in the shape I would like it.
Representative Hillstrom moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carried.
Madam Chair, with me today is County Attorney Tony Palumbo. This issue arose out of a case that came out of his office.
Mr. Palumbo, please proceed.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tony Palumbo. For the record, that's P-A-L-U-M-B-O. I am the Anoka County Attorney. I'm here this morning to testify in support of House File 410 as amended recently. This is an initiative to, we have an initiative in our office to address issues of abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation for the elderly. This situation has arisen, certainly, in the course of our prosecutions, where we have a victim who has passed away, and then there is no ability under current law to get restitution, certainly, to the family of that victim. We have discovered then, of course, the need to address this restitution when that victim passes away. And I believe this bill would address that particular situation where a victim, especially in a financial exploitation case, passes away and there's an ability to get restitution. There was one thing I would caution the committee on, however. Once restitution has been ordered or received by a court, I think the bill should address how that restitution is to be distributed, especially if there's no estate opened. And many times there's very little money left, usually in an estate, and it's generally not worthwhile for family members to go forward and incur the expense of opening an estate. However, if you get restitution in, there has to be some sort of a mechanism to distribute that restitution. And I have discussed this certainly this morning with Representative Hillstrom, and I think the committee might want to consider some sort of a solution to how we're going to distribute that restitution if no estate is opened. This time I would turn it over to Mr. Brian Lindbergh, who is Assistant County Attorney, who will explain a little bit further the mechanics of it. Brian.
Mr. Lindbergh.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian, B-R-Y-A-N, Lindbergh, L-I-N-D-B-E-R-G. I'm an assistant Anoka County Attorney and head up the Property and Drug Crime Division of the Anoka County Attorney's Office. This issue came to light this past year when our office was prosecuting a defendant who had conned an 82-year-old Fridley man out of a great sum of money. This 82-year-old man was suffering from Alzheimer's. He was befriended by the defendant. He and his female accomplice convinced this 82-year-old man that he should marry this 36-year-old female accomplice. They proceeded to convince him to buy two engagement rings to the tune of $16,000. He also signed his name onto a car loan for a 2008 Hummer. The two con people proceeded to liquidate this elderly gentleman's $71,000 bank account. They made $65,000 in withdrawals in about a 40-day period of time. The defendant was ultimately convicted. Unfortunately, the man who was suffering from Alzheimer's died before the conviction sentencing. So at the time of sentencing, the court was looking for guidance and direction as to how he could award restitution and who that should go to. Technically, under the statute, victim is a living person or an entity such as a company or a business. It does not fit the situation where the victim dies before the award of restitution. So we're proposing that the language in 611A.04 subdivision 6 be added to 611A to clarify the court's ability to award restitution where a victim has died before a sentencing has occurred or a request for restitution has been made, such as the situation we had in Anoka County.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question, and that is if the person that is needed, that's wronged the vulnerable adult is a family member, and one family member wants to get restitution from another family member that maybe was the who that adult was in the care of. Mm-hmm. Would this apply to getting the restitution from that family member?
Yes,
Mr. Lindberg. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and actually, I'd like to have Mr. Lindberg actually answer that question.
Okay. Mr. Lindberg.
The defendant would be prosecuted by office, would not be in a position to request restitution. It would only be the victim, the other family members, who would be allowed under the statute to make that request to the court.
So that was my question, is if one family member could bring an action against another family member?
Under the language of the statute, that could happen. That's true.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom, in your bill, if you look at the language on lines 10 through 12, I'm concerned, I think your intent is that if the victim has died, that an heir can have this right. Do you only become an heir when somebody's dead? In other words, I have a right to my parents' estate, and so I think this is more like a lawyer or a definitional kind of thing. Do we need to qualify that right only is available if the victim is dead? So that you wouldn't have a situation where you'd have heirs to an estate having this right before that person was dead.
Representative Hillstrom?
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, I believe under the statute that is the case. You don't become an heir until the person has passed. So nonpartisan staff certainly can clear that up, but from my law school days, I'm pretty sure my estates and trust class, that's what they taught us.
That's my understanding. Is you're not an heir unless someone has passed away.
Thank you, Ms. Mullins.
And Madam Chair and
Hillstrom
and members, as County Attorney Palumbo stated, there is some discussion about how that distribution might happen with the court. And because it's the court who actually orders who gets it, we will be addressing that issue in the Judiciary Committee. And Mr. Lake from the Bar Association has sent it to the estate section of the bar, and we are waiting comment.
Any other questions for the members? Seeing none, is there any public testimony? Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 410 be recommended to pass as amended and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary Finance and Policy. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Motion carried. Next on the agenda is House File 129. Representative Sanders, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And can I entertain somebody to move
Madam Chair.
Representative Sanders' bill?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 129.
Representative Scott moves that House File 129 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 129 is the bill in front of you that clarifies and modifies the definitions of a foreclosure consultant and applies the regulations in sections 325N to mortgage originators who are negotiating the terms of existing residential mortgages. With that, I have Mr. Elwood here as well, who can walk through maybe some more of the technical aspects that help maybe speak more of your language in front of the Civil Law Committee here.
Good morning, Mr. Elwood.
Yes. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I want to thank Representative Sanders for carrying this bill. This is a bill intended to close an unintended loophole in our mortgage foreclosure consultant statutes, 325N. A number of years ago, this statute was amended to address the problems that were emerging with loan modifications companies, fee-for-service folks who are charging homeowners to try to get loan modifications and try to save their homes from foreclosure. As you may know, there is a extensive statewide network of foreclosure prevention counseling. The Minnesota Housing Finance Agency operates it. You all appropriate money, and then they divide it up across the state to groups like Lutheran Social Services, Habitat for Humanity. Some of the local HRAs actually operate the program in different counties. There is a program in every county. That's a free service, but there is also an industry that charges for the same service. Obviously, from a homeowner standpoint, if the end result is a loan modification and they save their home, it matters probably not to them whether they go through the state program or a private business. But unfortunately, not all of the fee-for-service entities are as scrupulous as we'd like them to be. And we have had much experience with folks in that industry, and some of those folks, essentially taking the money and not providing the service. So several years ago, an amendment to 325N was added to prevent folks from taking the fees up front, do the service, get paid. And there are a whole other series of protections, contract disclosures, certain provisions of the contract, and really importantly, a no-waiver provision. So you can't waive your rights in a contract. What we have started to see over the last several years, as in most of these statutes, there are exemptions for businesses that really shouldn't be swept into the net, and mortgage originators was one. Obviously, a traditional mortgage originator is simply getting folks first-time loans or potentially refinancing their loans, but they don't typically do the loan modification aspect of it. So folks who were in the loan mod business saw an opportunity to essentially skirt the requirements of 325N. All they had to do was go down to the Department of Commerce and get a license, which has started to become a problem. So what this bill simply does is say, even if you have a licensed mortgage originator, you still have to follow the rules of 325N.
Members, questions? Seeing none, Representative Sanders renews a motion to Representative Scott renews the motion to that House File 129 be recommended to pass and be referred to Committee on Judiciary Finance.
Madam Chair, I don't know if it's the case, but you didn't ask if there's any testimony from the audience.
Thank you, Representative Holbrook. Any public testimony? Anybody that wants to testify in favor or in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, then Representative Scott renews her motion to that House File 129 be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Motion carried.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. Members, if you'll be patient, Representative Fritz is coming from downstairs. She should be here. Representative Fritz.
Madam Chair.
And welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will make the motion. I just am not sure where the bill needs to go next.
And I believe it's going to the general register.
Okay, Madam Chair, I would move that House File 483 be recommended to pass and be sent to the general register.
Oh, Ms. Madam Chair.
Representative Holbrook.
You are requiring the Department of Health to do a registry and additional testing. I don't know how there's not a cost with that.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We heard this bill in the Health and Human Service Policy. This is actually part of the governor's budget. And there's the budget piece is moving separately, so the budgetary aspect of it will be taken care of. Madam Chair and Representative Holbrook, the budget is actually, I believe it brings in funds because what's really in the governor's budget is an increase in the fee for testing, and it covers this. This is a very inexpensive test. It basically, well, you'll hear the testimony. It involves clipping a little monitor on the infant. And so it's really, it doesn't really, I think, have a separate cost, but it is part of the budget in the sense that there's a fee increase that covers this and some other things.
And Madam Chair and Representative Liebling, I understand all that, but this is a bill with a cost where you're asking an agency to do something. And that's part of the problem, I think, with this bill is because the agency bill has changes to newborn screening and other issues, and so with this moving separately, I think you're going to have some kind of lack of harmony between the agency's bill and this bill. And I'm not objecting to the test, right? I mean, I just, the process around this is a little awkward.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While the testimony is going on, I'll just quick run upstairs and make sure that if Huntley wants to see it, we know that Huntley wants to see it. I have no objection with while the testimony is going on, checking it.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Fritz.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. Representative Zerwas and I are presenting to you House File 483, and, you know, we want this. I'm passing a little treat out, too, from both of us, because we want our babies to be in the pink always and not in the blue. My experience recently is this, that I became a great-grandmother to baby Lily, who was born at 23 weeks. And, of course, immediately she was sent to it was in Children's Hospital and was 119 days at Children's Hospital. And she had her oxygen level checked continuously, actually. And I did see the little device that they use. And I am familiar with the oxygen, the pulse oximetry piece. It's about $6 to buy one. I used it a lot in my nursing home in the last 10 to 20 years when we were getting many people with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and we needed to check their oxygen level throughout the day to ensure that they had a good level, and they weren't always good. The day that the Heart Association had their event over at the Rotunda, I went over and I had my 102 checked, it was 98, and my pulse was 75. And I thought that was pretty good. So if you all have a 98 pulse oximetry, your lungs are pretty good. Oftentimes in the when babies are born, the only time that I, in my career and my colleagues in nursing, have come across a problem in an infant, a newborn, is when they see it. They'll look and see that a infant looks somewhat bluish, cyanosis, and then they immediately react. But that is the only observation, or the only tool that we have at this point, is the observation of the staff for that newborn. So this pulse oximetry would be used while that infant is there to check its oxygen and to ward off a cardiovascular accident or disease. So having just said my personal story, baby Lily is home. She's on oxygen continuously. Her little lungs are still not what they ought to be, but she is 7 pounds, 10 ounces, doing well. She's in the pink. And this young man to my right has been in Children's Hospital more than any of us would ever imagine, and I would like for Representative Zerwas to tell you a little bit about his story.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Fritz. So a little bit about my background, my story. I guess my story started 32 years ago when I was born. I was born at Mercy Hospital up in Coon Rapids, and my parents, they wanted a girl. They had two boys, and I was born, and they counted 10 fingers, 10 toes, and said, "You have a happy, healthy baby boy." And so I was named Nicholas instead of Holly. It was a Christmas baby. So, it wasn't until 3 days later that they were getting ready to discharge me from the hospital. And as they were getting ready, I started to cry and cry and cry, and they noticed all the color drained from my face and my lips turned purple. And my mom said she didn't really know what was going on, other than there was all of a sudden kind of a cloud of doctors and nurses that kind of swarmed in. And she said literally she followed through the hospital this swarm of doctors as I went from the nursery down and was loaded up into an ambulance. And they were told, "We don't know what's wrong with your child. We think it might be something with his heart, but you need to follow the ambulance to Children's Hospital in Minneapolis." My parents followed the ambulance down and got to the hospital. I had been taken into the ICU. And it was there that they were told that your son is not the happy, healthy baby boy we thought he was. In fact, your son Nicholas was born with a 3-chambered heart instead of 4. We need to do an emergency open heart surgery. And at this time, in 1980, there's nothing in medical science that will allow us to keep your son alive longer than 6 or 7 years. Now, in December, I turned 32, so we've had a lot of advancements since then. I've had 10 open-heart surgeries total. Throughout my life, I've been told 6 different times that I've had less than 6 months left to live. The last time, my parents and I just went, "No, you guys will figure out something," and they did, and they always did. And one of the things that in this time period that they figured out is pulse oximetry. And what becomes so vitally important is that these critical congenital heart defects manifest at about that 48-hour to 72-hour timeline a lot of times. And nowadays, unlike in 1980, a lot of times babies are home by then. And when that manifestation happens, when that baby becomes symptomatic, if they're at home and they're out of the hospital, the chance of serious, serious complications goes way up. And what ends up happening is the cost of emergent transport down, whether it's by ambulance or from Greater Minnesota by air ambulance down, by helicopter down. And treating a child that has had significant prolonged lack of oxygen. I know we heard in Health and Human Services Policy about a baby that had severe, prolonged lack of oxygen that led to multi-system organ failure. Those are the types of complications and severe impacts to health that can happen if this isn't caught and treated early. It's 1 out of every 100 births is a baby born with a congenital heart defect. 1%. It's more than all the childhood cancers combined. It's a significant issue, and it's something that we have an opportunity to catch early, and when you catch early, treatment is much, much more successful.
Thank you.
Representative Fritz?
Well, Madam Chair, I think that the testimony that you just heard certainly should more than educate all of us as to the importance of checking the oxygen level through the pulse oximetry of the newborn soon after the newborn arrives. And with that, I'm open for questions.
Before we go to questions, Representative Hillstrom, would you like to amend your motion to that House File 483 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register?
Yes, Madam Chair. I will amend my motion that House File 483 be recommended to pass and be sent to Health and Human Services Finance.
And Representative Hillstrom moves that House File 483 be recommended to pass and be sent to Health, Human Services and Finance. Representative Holbrook, you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious. Generally, these bills would go to the Data Practices Subcommittee, and so hopefully you can indulge me here just a little bit. With the registry, what data sets will be collected and how will they be used?
Do you want to do the amendment?
Yeah. We do have an amendment, actually, Madam Chair. Representative Holbrook, that addresses that. I believe the
Chair, I don't think the amendment addresses it. I'm asking you say you want the Department of Health to set up a registry. So what information will the Department of Health collect on babies and their families? How will they use it? Will it be available to outside sources? It looks like they're going to track these kids for 18 years through this registry, and I'm just wondering what's the purpose of it? How will it be used? Will it be available for research purposes? If a parent, my understanding is you're going to support the protocol in newborn screening, that there'd be an opt-in to this registry and research, but how would this information be used and what would be collected?
And I think we'll have the department respond to that. If you would come down, please.
And members, we're handing out a copy of the amendment to be considered, the A1 amendment.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Health. We're not familiar with the registry itself that's being set up in this bill to answer questions of what the data would be. I can only speak to the fact that that registry would be subject to the same statute that impacts the overall newborn screening program, and therefore would be subject to the consent after the data would be stored 2 years, and then it would need consent to continue to be used.
Well, and Madam
Holbrook,
Chair, my understanding is that the you have 2 year storage, but I don't think that translates into an automatic involvement in a registry. I'm guessing that you need consent to be part of a registry under current protocol for newborn screening, and so what is going to be in this registry? Who gets access to it? For what purposes? Are we going to be sending out lovely little flyers to people?
Mr. Copley.
Madam Chair, Representative Holbrook, what I can tell you clearly is that it would require consent beyond 2 years for any data to be stored, and that would include a registry. So up to 2 years, it would be available. As all of our data is now, would be stored for 2 years. Beyond that, as the statute states, the newborn screening statute states, and what was worked out last year, consent would be needed. I can't speak to the specifics of what's in the registry. That's, I think, more would be able to, perhaps some of the testifiers. I do have a Okay. So we do have some recommendations, but these are not impacted by, these would not change the statute, would not affect the consent needed. There is, in the data elements thus far recommended, if that's what you're interested in, demographic information, as is provided on a newborn screening card. No Social Security number is collected on either the baby or the mother. Pulse ox results, pass fail, and the raw percentage for the blood oxygen level. Time of the pulse ox readings and extremity information, whether the result was taken from the hand or the foot. Result of follow up echocardiogram, whether the CCHD was detected prenatally, the date of diagnosis, the date of surgery or intervention, final diagnosis, and outcomes after diagnosis. So those are the types of data that would be involved in the initial, I'm not sure how many, what time period, but in a fairly short time period.
And if I might, Madam Chair, then how would that information be used and who would it be shared with?
Mr. Copley.
I'm going to hand off this to Ms. Parks, who's our lab director.
Thank you.
Please state your name for the record.
Yes.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, my name is Joanne Bartkus. I'm a PhD. I'm the director of the Public Health Laboratory Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. As Jim mentioned, we're rolling this implementation of CCHD screening out in phases. And we're still in phase one, which is working out the implementation piece. So the right now, our role in CCHD is, you know, as it's been mentioned, this is a point of care screening. So it's a little different than the blood spot testing we usually do. So our collection and monitoring is a little bit different than what we've done in the past with the blood spot conditions. So our role is in trying to collect the data and compile it and then feed information back in aggregate, at least in part, to physicians, to the healthcare facilities, to make sure that there are no problems with the implementation, to be able to provide technical assistance, especially with, for example, cutoff points. So if we're seeing a lot of false positives, we might change the recommendations for what level of oxygen saturation might be actionable. So those are the sorts of things. We don't share private information. We're covered under Minnesota Statutes Chapter 13. So this data would be used primarily to feedback to the healthcare community to really enhance and to improve this process and to make it as effective as possible.
And Representative Holbrook.
And Madam Chair, I understand that then. Why the need for an 18-year registry?
Madam Chair and
Representative Fritz.
The amendment takes that out, the 18-year registry.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think maybe it'd be time to move the A1 amendment. And so, for Representative Fritz, I would move the A1 amendment.
Okay, A1 amendment has been moved. Any other discussion on that,
Mr. Chair?
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think maybe Representative Fritz would want to describe this amendment before we vote on it.
Well, the amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and representatives. This complies with the section 144.125 to 144.128, and it removes the 18-year-old following the 18 up until age 18.
Okay, Representative Holbrook.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, on line 12, it talks establishment of a registry, and on line 17, it says long-term follow-up services for children and their families.
Who's that question for, Representative Holberg?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I hear we don't have the 18 years anymore, but it appears that we still have a registry and we still have long-term follow-up services, and I just don't know what that means.
Representative Zerwas.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Holberg, I think basically what we're talking, and I think the Department of Health talked about the registry, the idea that we're going to be maintaining this as a check to the quality of the test and the parameters of the test. That's what the lab director just testified to, that we'd be using that information back to the test. The long-term follow-up services as provided by the Department of Health, that's, in reality, that's not new. Individuals that are diagnosed with a critical congenital heart defect, we're in for the long haul. As I said in HHS policy, when I go in twice a year now for my my cardiac follow-up. I still go to Children's Hospital. I tell people it's the only time that I get to feel like a big guy. I go in and my feet hang off the end at Children's Hospital. It's a long-term, it's a lifetime follow-up. And so the Department of Health is there as a resource for patients and for families that have a lifetime and a long-term need for follow-up care. And that's all that's being talked about in this.
Well, Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair and Representative Zerwas, some people believe that they don't need the Department of Health involved in their medical relationship with their doctor for long-term follow-up and care. And so I'm just trying to figure out the testimony that I heard around calibrating the tests, making sure that we're administering them at the right time, if we have false positives, if we need to redo that. I believe all of that is allowed under Subdivision 5 of the Newborn Screening Program that allows the Department of Health to collect data around those types of issues. I'm concerned that when we put our kids into registries held by government, that we know what they're going to be doing with them and how they're going to be used. And I haven't heard beyond the testimony of the director, I haven't really heard how, and I don't believe your amendment does away with long-term follow-up service. And does this mean the Department of Health is going to be tracking these kids throughout their lives, and for what purpose?
Representative Portman, to that point.
Well, Representative Holberg, what I wonder is if that line 1.14, that language that says that act as a resource for providers, modifies the language at 1.17. So what they're talking about at 1.17 is long-term follow-up services that would be provided by the healthcare provider. It's just the Department of Health is interested in acting as a resource for those providers. I understand and I hear your concern that what you don't want to do is create a different branch of data storage from what's in the Newborn Screening Act. And I don't see anything in this language that allows them to set up a system that's different from or in contradiction to the Newborn Screening data provisions, because then I would think they would need some language that says notwithstanding sections, you know, and then cite the relevant statute that they're attempting to modify. So I wonder, and you know, you're the expert, but if the language at 1.10 and 1.12 about establishing the data collection and the registry, those are constrained by what we already have in existing law regarding the newborn registry, and so that this can't expand the methods of data collection and storage without specific statutory grant of power, I guess, is how I'm reading the amendment. I'm hoping that what the amendment actually does is address your concerns.
Representative Holberg.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Hartman, I don't really care what people sign up for when they sign up and they know full well what they're getting into. Doesn't bother me in the least if the Department of Health wants to track these kids for 18 years and, you know, automatically have a push-through of their physicals or how they're doing in FIED. I really don't care, but what I do care about is that when parents sign up for this, they know exactly how the information about their kids is going to be used, who has access to it, what their rights are for opting out if they get a year or two into it and they really don't like all the brochures and the follow-up calls that, you know, come as a result of this.
Right.
You know, so I'm trying to get a feel for how this is going to be applied, and I'm getting the sense that there really isn't a lot of structure around how this registry will be used beyond what I believe they already have the authority to do without a registry.
Representative Horton.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holbrook, but they're constrained by all those protections that are already in statute that you're talking about, unless they ask us to be excused from them. And I'm not seeing any language here that would put this data collection project above the constraints that they have to deal with in the existing newborn screening program. So I am seeing is all the work that's already been done to protect parents in the way that you're discussing that's in the newborn screening statute applies to this data collection project. And they're not getting any ability to do here anything that's in contradiction with the existing statutes. That's the way I'm reading it.
Representative Holbert.
Well, Mr. Chair, they get to do a registry. And it appears that it's a long-term registry. That's beyond what current newborn. We're not going to solve this here today.
Okay. Well, why don't
we do that? My understanding that the department also has a bill that addresses this that'll have the funding. It's like I said earlier, this is a little awkward in that we have the Heart Association bill here in front of us. There's another bill from the department that addresses some of the same issues. As time goes on, maybe we can, you know, figure out the nuances of this. I'm hoping that the department's data bill actually gets to go to the data practices subcommittee. I've suggested to them that maybe they carve out that portion of their budget bill as a separate bill so that we would have a little more ease in dealing with those issues. I don't know whether they'll take me up on that or not, but I just have concerns that we don't have a clear understanding as public policymakers what the function, role, and results of this registry are going to be.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What Representative Holbrook just stated is exactly my concern. I echo her concerns. I am unclear about what the need is for the registry. And I'm not certain who to direct that to, who could share some information with me that would give me a comfort level that a registry is necessary in this particular matter.
Representative Ross.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holberg, Representative Pugh. I think it's important to point out that the A1 amendment is the exact language from the MDH budget. So this is the language that you just said you were wishing it was. This A1 amendment is the exact language from the governor's budget. And as far as the registry, I think we have other testifiers that could talk about some of the implications of the registry.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you. I would be delighted to hear what the Minnesota Department of Health has to say. I am referring back to Representative Hortman's comment about, yes, it's clear that the Minnesota Department of Health would like to provide this service, but again, I'm really looking for clarity about why this registry is necessary.
Mr. Koppel, you have an answer for Representative Pugh's question.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, my name is Jim Koppel. I'm the Deputy Commissioner. Briefly, we currently maintain under current law a registry of the cases of hereditable and congenital disorders detected by the screening program for the purpose of follow-up services. That is subject to that any data, again, is subject to the two-year limit and then would need consent. So the idea of a registry, though, is to provide those follow-up services when consent is gathered for longer term, So you need to have the vehicle by which to deliver those services. You need to have the infrastructure or the ability to do it. And so that's the purpose of a registry, and our registry. And I believe that without that, then you're saying the law would say don't do it at all. And if we do have consent, we wouldn't even have a process by which we could provide those additional longer-term follow-up services. So the registry is a tool and a valuable tool to be used. But again, the data falls under the statutory language requiring a consent at 2 years. That's clear.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Urso. No, Representative Urso passes. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On this registry, don't go away, Department of Health. Is this registry used for all children or only those that get a positive result from the testing?
Mr. Koppel.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, only those with a positive result.
Representative Scott?
Okay. So any other further discussion on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, then all in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. So to the bill as amended, Representative Fritz, Representative Zerwas, I came in late. Okay, so we're taking public testimony now, I understand it. Any testimony from the public?
Okay.
Okay, Ms. Braze is here, I understand. Please come down and introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the public. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And I would like to just share a few things with you about the bill that is before you now on the heart screening. So one of the things that we look at when we look at this is we look at what is the role of the government in medical care. And we're concerned about the fact that here is another example of the health department, the government telling hospitals and doctors what they have to do. And we look at this as precedent setting yet another thing. What will be the next thing that the government tells doctors and hospitals that they must do? What's the next thing that all the taxpayers have to look at for when the government decides some procedure must be done? And parents are at a time where I've heard them say things like, my wife couldn't even remember what we named our child. We're all in a fog. It's a very frenetic time. Anyone who has had children probably remembers this. There's nothing wrong at all with doing the screening, but we're concerned about the fact that it's the government mandating it and the government paying for it. So parents should have the option to know what it is, and we really believe that health plans, if this is so important to save the lives of children, health plans should really be concerned about this, and they should probably be the ones doing it. But on the essence of the data, if you'll look at the bill with me, and I'm going to direct your attention to the amendment. So on the amendment, lines 1.12, which talks about the registry, that's an important distinction, the distinction between a database and a registry. So a registry is about positive cases that they have found. Now, one thing that's not clear in here is whether positive cases that turn out to be false positive cases will actually be deleted from the registry, or will once they have been found, that information will just stay there. And people who have actually had false positives, they will continue to be in this government registry. Another thing that I heard about the registry was that it had to follow the same law as the rest of newborn screening. But as I recall, and I was going to look it up really quickly and haven't, but I'm sure the health department knows the answer to this, I believe that all positive tests for newborn screening do not get thrown away after 2 years. Anyone that is a positive test goes on in perpetuity. So what we have here is a registry of these folks. The data would not go away for 2 years, but would go on forever in this registry. I'd also like to point your attention to lines 1.15 and 1.16, where we talk about develop and implement policies. Well, I look at that and I look at what's happening in healthcare today, and I think, is this going to be part of the quality measurement for a practitioner, for a clinic. You know, Representative Hortman or Hillstrom, I can't quite remember which, talked about it being acting as a resource. But if the department creates and develops and implements policies, perhaps it will be a requirement, a mandatory requirement in the future that they do follow up 18 years or beyond, because I think, as opposed to the original bill, the way the language is now in line 1.17, long-term follow-up for children and their families identified, it doesn't end at 18 years. It could go on forever. And so, you know, I look at this and I think, you know, what we're creating is just another tracking system and another reason for the government to get into your private life and to track you when a parent may not want this. Even a parent with a positive result, even a child with a positive result in their adulthood may not want to be tracked forever. So I think what we're doing is creating another system. Now, I have something I'm going to pass out to you because I think it's important, and we call this under surveillance, because what it has on the back, types of data collected, birth, death, marriage, adoption, birth defects, cancer, diabetes, DNA, as we know that's been changed a bit, HIV, AIDS, genetic test results, sexually transmitted diseases, strokes, trauma registry, and vaccinations. These are all data collection systems currently in law today. And what this has here is the actual name of the system, the year it began, the number of people in the databases, whether the name's included, and if there's consent. And in no case is there consent. And even in this, there's no consent. And so I draw your attention to what has been handed out to you, because I think it's important to see what parents actually get. So here's what parents get at the hospital, according to the website. And you'll see in here, at the very back of it, it says, "What if I do not want my infant tested?" So it does give an option. It's a little better than it used to be with the newborn screening. But then I just want to point out to you this parent consent form about storage and use of the spots in the test results, because this is similar to what it's going to be for the what we're considering today. If you go to page 2, it says, "What are the risks of storing my child's newborn screening blood spots or test results?" And it says that the only risk is that the blood spots or test results could be identified. Well, in fact, as to point out to how clear or unclear or nonspecific this is and could be for this new test that we're talking about here, there are so many other risks, like the fact that the government owns your child's DNA, like the fact that DNA is now considered not only identifiable, but if it's unidentified, it can still be re-identified. And a new study, I think, talked about that in the Wall Street Journal. So, you know, there are other risks in here that are not even talked about or given, parents aren't given an opportunity to think about. But then the last thing I'm going to point out is the back. So here's the so-called Tennyson warning. And it is a Tennyson warning, except what does it say at the top? Parental consent for MDH to store and use newborn screening blood tests, blood spots, and test results. Attached Tennyson warning. See, Tennyson warning should be what's in big black bold, because this doesn't look really any different. The Tennyson warnings that I have seen previously have had Tennyson warning as the big bold statement on top. But this, you actually have to get to the subtitle. How many parents are going to get to the subtitle to see that this is actually a warning about the government taking their data and using their data? So I'm concerned about the long-term history of the health department not really fully informing parents about their rights to opt out, but also how obscure even the warning is after it was put into law last year. So I just wanted to bring these things to your attention. We obviously oppose another type of testing, another government-directed type of testing, and then I will pass these out to you.
Thank you, Ms. Perez. Representative Hortman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, there are just a number of statements there that were made that were not accurate. On line 1.14, where it says that the health department can act as a resource for providers, is not the same thing as the health department requiring a mandate that providers do X, Y, or Z. The testifier also indicated that parents don't get information, don't get an opportunity to opt out, and they absolutely do. Line 1.18 says that this the Department of Health has to comply with sections 144.125 to 144.128. And in that section of statute, we clearly spell out that a parent can refuse the screening, that a parent is informed before the screening happens. All the protections that Representative Holberg and others have worked so hard to secure are in that language. and provided to parents. So this isn't something different than, apart from the restrictions on collection of data in newborn screening. They are required under line 1.18 in existing law to comply with sections 1.44125 to 144128, and all those protections for parents that you just indicated don't happen are spelled out in those sections of statute.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Brish.
Yes, I'd like to respond to that. I didn't say that they don't get an opt-out. I said that the opt-out is on here. It's on here. I pointed out that it's on here. It's on the back. It's better than it used to be. The notification for parents is better than it used to be, because it used to be in an accordion-type little pamphlet where it was about 7 or 8 folds in. So it's here, and it's better than it used to be. My point is that parents are in a fog. It has to be very clear to them that they have a right to opt out, and it would be very good for them to think about why. For instance, that the government, this is all going to the government. It's not really the hospital that's keeping the data. It's the government keeping the data. So that's one of the things that's often not informed about. And the other piece, which maybe I didn't make clear, about acting as a resource, implementing develop and implement policies, the law, both here and in federal government, is starting to measure doctors according and then pay them according to their compliance with the way the government wants medicine practiced. And so there are performance measurements, and accordingly they are often or can be fined, in other words, reduced payments. And so we're looking at the entire quality measurement system and wondering whether this will be part of the quality measurement in the future once the health department has helped them to develop the policies. So that's our point. We're just connecting the dots, saying that that is a possibility in the future, that even though it's not the health department doing it, that just the pure fact that they could be financially penalized potentially in the future might happen. I'm not saying it is. I'm saying it might.
Representative Liebman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't want to respond to the specifics here at all, except to say that there are clearly a couple of different worldviews going on here. And I think that it's utterly appropriate to have consent and the protections that we have around the newborn screening program and all of that. But the two different worldviews here are clearly whether government is a force that can be good and helpful in people's lives, or whether it's kind of an evil entity that's going to invade all our privacy and make us do things that we don't want to do. And clearly I subscribe to the first and view that I mentioned, that, and I think newborn screening is a very good example of that, because if you hear the testimony, we heard some of it today, and most of you aren't in health policy, you didn't get a chance to really hear more of the testimony around this, but in the whole newborn screening program, and I hope that you'll all be able to hear about this if you haven't already, the ability to save babies and to save them from a life of disability or to save them from an early death is absolutely astounding. And if you want to say that government shouldn't have access to data and shouldn't be able to, then you're really basically saying that we shouldn't go forward and we shouldn't try to be able to do research, and we shouldn't be able to save babies that we can't save today. And that's really kind of what this is about. In saying that, I'm not saying that every person should just turn over their data and we don't care what happens to it. Absolutely we do. But to say that somehow the private sector is the great guardian here, which Ms. Brays did mention, the health plans should do this. Well, you know, why the private sector has the white hat and the government has the black hat, I don't know. But with appropriate protections and appropriate transparency, these are absolutely life-saving programs, and you heard Representative Zerwas testify to that what he's been through. And if you had heard the testimony in health policy, the ability to detect this early with this test we're talking about in this bill, which is a little simple clip-on thing that gives you a number. It doesn't take your DNA or any of that anyway in this bill. But it's a little clip-on thing, and you get a number. And that can be an absolutely life-saving, life-changing thing for a child and a family. So I just wanted to point that out, Mr. Chair, that we do have these very different visions going on here. And it's really unfortunate that people are kind of in some respects, set up here to fear all of this, and instead of realizing that with appropriate protections, that this can be an absolutely, this is about health, and it's about health of babies, it's about families and their futures, and ultimately, too, it's about the costs of having ongoing terrible disability when we can save babies very early on by having appropriate testing and appropriate research and appropriate protections around the use of this data.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Other comments? Representative Howe.
And Mr. Chair, is there any information out there as far as, because having been a former EMT and we use this seminar all the time, is there anybody that doesn't do this? That doesn't, I mean, I take it that this is all this is doing is collecting, shouldn't say all this is doing, but what this does is collect and place a registry. But as far as saving babies, we collect this data, this data for the newborn, we put this thing on them right away anyway.
Well,
as an EMT, we did, so.
How the Department of Health can probably answer that. Mr. Koppel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, it is true you do collect it in your profession and in the neonatal intensive care, perhaps with babies at risk. It would be collected, but not on a normal delivery. And that's where it's not detected, not picked up, and where so many of these children are missed. So it's expanding its use to all newborns as opposed to just those that present a risk.
Representative Howe? Okay. Any other questions for the testifiers? Any other comments regarding House File 483 as amended? Representative Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if Representative Simon would consider, and the bill's author would consider having this heard in data practices. I know we're going to have a meeting a week from today, I believe, or a week from tomorrow. And I'm just wondering if this bill could be heard there.
For Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Typically, you don't send a bill that doesn't make a change to the data practices law to data practices if you're making no changes. And it's my understanding, based on the amendment, that we're making no changes.
That's my understanding, too, Representative Scott. This would be the committee to discuss what we have here today for the purposes of the sections of the bill we're talking about. I don't see a need to send it to data practice. Representative Simon?
I would agree, Mr. Chair. I mean, there are a lot of bills and a lot of committees that deal with government data that don't necessarily trigger the Government Data Practices Act, at least not explicitly. If we were to send every bill to the subcommittee that dealt with government data in some way or that could conceivably impact the Data Practices Act, it would be a much busier subcommittee than it is. So it's really up to you, Mr. Chair, so I'm punting because you're the chair of the full committee, but I don't know that this bill needs to go there explicitly. We could have a discussion about it in the committee, as we've done with the Health Exchange, for example, when we didn't have a bill before us. But in terms of sending the entire bill there, I'm not so sure that it needs to make a stop.
Right, thank you. Representative Holbert.
Mr. Chair, and I think there is a change in that they're starting a new registry, but I also, there's a larger Department of Health bill that should definitely go to the Data Practices Subcommittee that gets around the what we call the get-out-of-jail-free card for a year issue. And so, I mean, I would like to have more information from the Department of Health on how this registry is going to be used, et cetera, but I'm thinking that there'll be other opportunities as we look at other bills that the Department of Health is going to bring that I certainly think need to go to the data practices. I think we need more information on the registry that we don't have yet, but to keep this bill here and send it, I think we're going to get a couple opportunities at this.
Representative Scott.
I just want to add one other thing to add, and that is, Representative Liebling alluded to the fact that she didn't understand why people would fear government, and I was one of the ones that the DNR, the database was cracked into, and I was one of the ones who's personal information was compromised, and that's a direct result of government collecting data And this is what we're doing here, and we're continuing to do it with the health care exchange bill in a very dangerous fashion. And I know people that are more afraid of their own government than they are of somebody from the outside bothering them. So I think that's just, you know, you are talking about two separate worldviews. And the founders of this country said that the government shouldn't be large and intrusive and in the middle of all of our lives collecting. I mean, they would have had no idea the amount of data that could be collected on us. And I think it's very important to scrutinize every time the government collects 1 ounce of information on any of us.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, Representative Scott, I'm actually a person who is quite concerned about surveillance and all of those kinds of things. And I think I signed on Representative Holbert's bill about license plate data. And I'm actually quite concerned about that. But where I really differ, I think, is in the idea that the private sector is somehow okay. You know, the private sector, if you have a cell phone or a laptop or anything, you're giving away tons of data. People are collecting data on you. If any of you have the location turned on your cell phone, mm-hmm. companies are collecting data about where you are. That's the private sector, not the public sector. So I'm not saying there's nothing to worry about. In fact, I've kind of noticed that young people don't seem to care that much about that data collection. I do care about it. But I just think that, you know, if we're going to worry, and I'm not saying we shouldn't worry. I'm not saying take off all limits on collection of data. And things do happen, and I agree they're very concerning. I'm just saying that we can actually, we're in a world where data is collected. And we have the ability here to put some controls around it and to do our best. But the bottom line is that there's a flip side to that. Data collection can lead us to some very, very good advances. And if you think that we would be living the lives we live now without data collection, you're wrong. Because an awful lot of things that we take for granted in health care, for example, would not be there without some data collection. The ability to have advances to cure cancer and to do all kinds of other things, particularly in healthcare, are the result of being able to collect data and do research on that data. So, you know, we are, I don't think we're in a completely different world in the sense that you care about surveillance and data, and I don't. I do care about it. I just don't see government as wearing a black hat and the private sector as wearing a white hat. I think the actual concern is more in the private sector, where we don't have the ability to regulate it, and people just assume that it's fine, because when you want to play a game on your cell phone, on your smartphone, you're willing to give access to all your contacts and everything else and your location, and people seem to think it's fine to trade that away, or either that or they don't know they're doing it.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, members. I do have a testifier here that I would like you to hear from. If we could go to the testifier.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. My name is Anna Marie Saarinen. I serve on three federal health IT working groups that work on data privacy and security and also health information exchange. I am also the founder of an organization called One in 100 to Representative Durvas's point that only 1% of all of our babies are born with congenital heart disease. Also, the chairman of the Newborn Foundation, which is to leverage actually health information technology to improve outcomes and reduce disparities for newborns and infants. Most importantly, among all of that, is that I am the mother of three children, the youngest of which was diagnosed with congenital heart disease at 48 hours of age. First, I'm sorry, this whole thing has thrown me off my game, so please bear with me. I think it's awesome that Ms. Braze was able to share her in-depth knowledge of identifiable and de-identifiable and re-identifiable DNA. I think it's not awesome that we're using that as a reason to sort of try to sabotage a bill that has nothing to do with DNA. So let me just reiterate for the probably 50th time in this meeting that we're not talking about DNA. We're talking about a number. It's no different than a baby's temperature or blood pressure. It's a pulse oximetry reading. It's considered the fifth vital sign. The gentleman who works as an EMT knows this is just a very common method of determining blood oxygenation. So it's a data point, but again, it is data, and it's important to know what is and isn't being collected. However, I hope we're not going to compare this sort of data that can save and improve lives for children with a database over at the DNR or any other database, quite frankly, because in health, it is a different game. And fortunately, we live in a world now where we do have the ability to understand and to opt out. The advancements we've seen come out of our state and through the institutions that we have here have been mind-boggling, quite frankly. If my daughter had been born when my son was born 15 years ago, she would not be alive. They would have not had the techniques to be able to repair her heart defects, much like Representative Zerwas's amazing story. Those advancements don't happen on their own. They happen because we have data. And even something as simple as a pulse oximetry screen to know how many babies have passed, how many babies have failed, what were those, what were their pulse oximetry readings, and what was the final diagnosis. Those are all so important for us to know whether the thing is actually working. Believe me, 2 years down the road, we have the data to show that not a single baby has been detected using pulse oximetry screening. I'll be the first one to come here and tell you to pull the plug on the whole damn thing. But if we don't measure it, we simply don't know. So the other thing I wanted to say is that the Minnesota Department of Health has been incredibly proactive in looking at this issue. I came to them 3 years ago after my daughter survived her surgeries and asked them if they would be interested in looking at a pilot program with the University of Minnesota and several other hospitals to start looking at whether or not this screening was effective at detecting heart disease early in babies so that we didn't have kids going home undiagnosed. And they were very interested and very helpful and very collaborative. And as you probably know, this has been statutorily added to our panel of things we screen newborns for in this country. And I'd like to commend them for that. I'm an advocate. I'm with an advocacy organization. The Heart Association is here. We're not perfect. We might mess it up. We tried to talk amongst each other to find language that was helpful from everyone's perspective. And maybe what I wanted was maybe different than what the Heart Association wanted, and maybe it was different than what MDH might have wanted. But this isn't an MDH bill. This was an advocate bill. And I'm sorry if it's not perfect. I personally don't care whether the word registry gets taken out. But the rest of it's not a bad bill. And the data collection is incredibly important. So I would fight tooth and nail and go toe-to-toe with anybody that says collecting data, again, collecting data is different than long-term registry and retention. But in those early days, knowing what those pulse oximetry results are to help determine what's helping the kids and where program improvements can be made. Finally, I just want to help you to understand, again, this is something not done in the well baby nursery. When I embarked on this journey 3 years ago, less than 1/3 of 1% of all babies in this country were being screened with a pulse oximetry test that takes about a minute. And we are losing 4,000 babies a year in this country to critical heart lesions. About 1/3 of those, arguably, could be avoided if they're diagnosed early enough. Because of the pathway we took, and with Minnesota as a great model, at the federal level, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services recommended this screening for all 4.2 million newborns in this country. Endorsed by the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Heart Association, the College of Cardiology, the March of Dimes, and the Newborn Foundation. Today, we stand at over 12% of new, over 12% of newborns are now being screened. And that's in just over 1 year's time since the Secretary of Health and Human Services recommended this screening. That may not sound great because it's still only 1 in 10 newborns, but by federal standards and by state implementation standards, that's actually moving by the speed of light. I'm very proud of Minnesota that we're actually screening a lot of our kids. But we have a lot of work to do. And all this bill was intended to do was actually accelerate adoption, improve access to the training and ability to implement, particularly at rural hospitals and hospitals that might be a little bit slower on the uptake on a screening like this. And those are the kids that are obviously more likely to fall through the cracks anyway because their prenatal detection rate is lower. and then meant to allow an easy mechanism for hospitals to report their screening results to the State Department of Health as a population health tool. I know there's a lot of people that don't like data, but I do know that without it, there would not have been the significant advancements in treatment and care that have happened today. Any family can opt out. We all know that. I had three kids. It is a fog. I mean, let's be honest. But I'm not an idiot. And if I were an idiot, I would certainly rather know about the screenings that could save my child's life and that they've happened than to just assume that it's better to have them not happen. Finally, 4 years ago, my daughter's little heart, about the size of a walnut, was struggling to beat for about 3 months. And she, when she had her surgery, had about a week left to live. So she has a very brave heart. I'm very proud of what she has helped accomplish in other states across this country. And I get an email every week from a family somewhere whose child has gone home undetected and has had serious compromise or been buried in a casket the size of a shoebox. This still happens almost every day. We need to stop that. And this is a very simple way to do it. I would have her here with me today because she's incredibly cute and incredibly persuasive. But she just had a brain tumor removed 12 days ago. But because her heart is so strong, she's doing great. She was sleeping in this morning, and she'll be happy to hear of the leadership of this committee and helping protect the lives of children like her. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Sarandon. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that powerful testimony. And I think what you've just experienced here is there are issues with the registry. And we do see the importance of the screening itself. You've just testified to the importance of that. And I don't know, Representative Fritz, if you would take this as a friendly amendment or not, but on line 1.12, to remove and the establishment of a CCHD registry.
Representative Fritz.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, no, I would not consider that that amendment.
Thank you, Representative Scott.
I'd like to offer it nonetheless.
Okay. If I could have research restate the amendment as offered by Representative Scott.
So, Mr. Chair, members, the proposed amendment can be seen in the A1 amendment, line 1.12, delete, comma, and the establishment of a CCHD registry.
Any questions about the amendment as offered by Representative Scott? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Any other questions by members of the committee regarding the bill? Seeing none, then Representative Hillstrom has moved that House File 483 be recommended to pass and be sent to Health and Human Services Finance Committee.
As amended.
As amended.
As amended. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. There being no other...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
We've done the minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. There being no other business before the committee, noting that the next meeting is Tuesday, the 26th at 8:15, committee is adjourned.